Seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument now in 070970, Laurie Smith and Howard Smith versus Patrick W.Y. Tam Trust.
The court, Mr. Rainin will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Today, I will address the following four issues. First, attorneys' fees need to be reasonable under the criteria established by the Supreme Court in Arthur Anderson versus Perry Equipment Corporation. Second, precedential authority of the Texas Supreme Court is, like in Arthur Anderson, is lost when lower courts no longer adhere to controlling Supreme Court decisions. Third, the trial court is the appropriate venue for determining the amount of fees, if any, to be awarded. And fourth, evidence of attorney's fees need to be properly proven up, although even when proven up, the fees must still be reasonable under the criteria established in the Arthur Anderson decision.
Could you start by explaining how, in your opinion, the lower court did not adhere to our precedent?
Your Honor, the lower court, in its opinion in this case, did not discuss Arthur Anderson at all. Arthur Anderson has been the controlling law on the award of attorney's fees since its decision in 1997. An important aspect of Arthur Anderson is that it incorporated 8 specific factors for the fact finder to take into account when evaluating the award of attorney's fees. And these factors are taken directly from Rule 1.04 of the Texas Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct. And this reflects a mirroring of not only legislative but also judicial doctrines. That's why we believe these factors are so important. And by failing to consider them, that's where the Fifth Court of Appeals failed to adhere to Supreme Court precedent.
You think the court, the Fifth Court, properly interpreted and applied Ragsdale?
Your Honor, I believe that they properly considered Ragsdale, but Ragsdale is not the controlling law on this issue. The controlling law is Arthur Anderson. That's not only can we see that from the Arthur Anderson decision itself, but we also look at 2 recent decisions of this court in Barker v. Ekman and Young v. Qualls, which specifically incorporate and discuss Arthur Anderson. In particular, the results obtained factor in both of those decisions.
Do you think Ragsdale was wrongly decided?
Judge, it's not for me to decide if Ragsdale was wrongly decided.
We know that, but what's your opinion?
I believe that the Arthur Anderson opinion is a better opinion in that it purposefully redefined and provided for more detail and objectivity rather than the criteria initially established in Ragsdale. Now,
on Arthur Anderson then? I mean, the doctor, when a doctor gets on the stand and says, we charged $50,000 for this surgery and it's reasonable and necessary, the doctor doesn't have to say what the risks were in the surgery and what other people in the community charge, how many hours were involved in the surgery. They just say, bottom line, this is it. Why is Arthur Anderson so sacred that we have all these hoops you got to go through for attorneys?
Well, Your Honor,
what's the big deal? If the guy just gets on the stand and says these things, yes, he should go into the details. Of course, somebody maybe ought to cross-examine him about the details. But if the parties don't want to fight over how many hours were involved, and one just says it's this many thousand, the other one says nothing, doesn't object or anything, why isn't that good enough?
Well, Your Honor, there's specific language in Arthur Anderson that says that the mere fact that a party and a lawyer have agreed to a particular fee does not mean that fee agreement in and of itself is reasonable for shifting the burden to the defendant.
We've got more here. The attorney gets on the stand and says it's reasonable. He's not saying just my client agreed to it. It's outrageous. He's saying it's reasonable.
The reasonableness, Your Honor, also comes not First of all, the attorney has to prove up those fees, but even if they are proven up, they still must be reasonable in light of the results ultimately obtained. Otherwise, Your Honor, what we're getting into is an issue where attorney's fees could potentially become a new form of punitive damages, which is explicitly within the province of the legislature. Now, in this case, Your Honors, the Fifth Court of Appeals did not look to Arthur Anderson at all, and they arbitrarily ruled for unreasonable attorney's fees, which equaled 72.9% of the ultimate damages that were awarded. Now, this award is contrary to the jury's verdict, the trial court's order, and the Supreme Court precedent, not only of Arthur Anderson, but also in subsequent decisions, most recently in Barker v. Eckman and Young v. Qualls.
Would you be complaining plaintiff had recovered all they were seeking?
If the plaintiff had recovered all they were seeking, which, of course, they didn't in this case.
Right. But if they had?
If they had, Your Honor, then the fees that they are seeking and which were awarded by the Court of Appeals are much more in line with the established criteria of Arthur Anderson. It still, though, is incumbent upon the plaintiff to actually go through and prove up the attorney's fees. So if the attorney's fees are properly proven up with the and had the respondent recovered what they were actually seeking, in that circumstance, then yes, the fees could be considered reasonable under the Arthur Anderson criteria.
I know, but would you say the Court of Appeals could award them, or does the Court of Appeals have to send it back to the trial court?
Well, the trial court is the proper venue for determining these attorney's fees, and that is one of our points here today. What began with Supreme Court precedents in Great American Reserve versus Britain and has continued throughout Ragsdale versus Progressive Voters League, Arthur Anderson, Barker, and Young, is that the trial court is the appropriate venue to determine these attorney's fees. The decision in Ragsdale.
Court in general, the jury in particular.
Well, the reasonableness of attorney, actually, Judge, Your Honor, the issue of attorney's fees is a question for the trier of fact. So it would depend on whether it was a bench trial, of course, or a jury trial.
But in this case, it was a jury.
It was a jury trial, yes, Your Honor.
And the jury said zero.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you don't disagree. That can't be right.
Your Honor, the jury was the one who actually examined all of the evidence. And the jury in this case.
But if we were talking about somebody who broke an arm in a car wreck and went to see the doctor and got it set and all this stuff, and the doctor says it's $5,000, and the jury said zero. Yes, you're liable. You ran the red light, but the reasonable damages from your broken arm is zero. There's no question under Texas law. That's wrong, and we're going to have to do it again.
Your Honor, in a situation like that, you would have to consider all of the evidence that
I just gave you all the evidence. They got a broken arm, and they had to go to the doctor to get it fixed. And if the jury says zero, that answer is unacceptable. We're going to have them or another jury try harder.
And if that's the case, Judge, under Kane versus Bain, a trial court or an appellate court can overturn a jury's verdict if it is overwhelming, if it is contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence.
And same thing would be true here. There's no evidence these people could have come in court and won their case with zero attorney's fees.
Well, that goes to the...
That's just flat wrong.
And, Your Honor, that goes to the issue of the degree to which the attorney's fees are actually proven up. The Dilston House decision clearly states that when present a party seeking to have attorney's fees awarded...
The jury didn't know anything about Arthur Anderson in this case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
What procedural ground would they have decided, not proven up enough, therefore zero?
Well, Your Honor, they could look at, for example, the testimony that was presented, which was their lone witness was Mr. Hayes, respondent's counsel, who testified for the work not only of himself but of six other lawyers who were not present at trial. He also testified and submitted billing for the work done by his co-counsel at trial, who chose not even to testify. The jury was given... The jury was given no evidence from Mr. Hayes' testimony as to what his hourly rate was, what his co-count, what his second chair's hourly rate was. The jury did not hear the motions that Mr. Hayes wrote. They did not hear how many hours he put in, what hearings he attended. They were given a general statement of reasonableness.
What did the legal bills, was there a detail in the legal bills about hourly rate and what the work was done for and that sort of thing?
There was, Your Honor. It is our position, though, that those legal bills were not the proper predicate was not laid to establish those legal bills as an exception to the hearsay rule.
The jury had that information.
They did have that information, Your Honor, yes. Yes.
You say the jury was not charged on the Anderson factors?
They were not charged on the Anderson facts, Your Honor. I don't know if it's been commonplace to charge, but it might be to charge a jury with that, but it might be after this decision is written.
Was there an objection to the failure to so charge the jury?
No, Your Honor, there was not. There was an objection, however, given to the records when they were offered, and it is our position that that objection should have been sustained.
You mean the legal bills?
To the legal bills, yes, Your Honor.
Now, the Court of Appeals, in citing Ragsdale, did tick off the factors, at least many of them, that you called that are referred to as the Arthur Anderson factors. Nature and complexity of the case, nature of the services provided, time required for trial, amount of money involved, client's interest at stake, responsibility imposed upon counsel, skill and expertise required. What is deficient about those factors in light of Arthur Anderson?
Well, for example, Your Honor, they are the Arthur Anderson incorporates not only the amount involved, which is what Ragsdale discusses, but it talks about the amount involved and the results obtained. Another important distinction between Arthur Anderson and Ragsdale has to do with Arthur Anderson adds a component of the fee customarily charged in the locality for similar circumstances. Nothing like that is present in the Ragsdale criteria. Ragsdale also talks about the time required for trial, but Arthur Anderson actually is more specific on that. That's the time and labor involved, the novelty and difficulty of the questions covered. It focuses more on just the trial itself.
So if it goes back to trial, get a jury charge on the Arthur Anderson factors, and the jury comes back with $47,000, you're okay with that?
Your Honor, I'm not. Your Honor, we would not be okay with that because, again, the fees still have to be reasonable in light of the results obtained.
Well, if the jury thought so.
I understand that, Your Honor. If the jury thinks that, though, it is incumbent upon the appellate courts to examine the evidence to see if it is contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence, which is what's been discussed as Kane versus Bain. The same factors that would govern the overturning a jury verdict of zero could also overturn a jury verdict of $47,438.75. It would be the same standard.
What if the jury is charged on Arthur Anderson factors and there is no evidence of two or three of those factors?
If there is no evidence of two or three of those factors, Your Honor, then it is our position that the fees should not be upheld. While an attorney does not need to testify to all of the Arthur Anderson factors, the Arthur Anderson factors still need to be satisfied for the proper recovery of those fees.
Well, then they're not factors. They're prerequisites. I mean, the difference in factors and prerequisites is factors are these things you think about in kind of way, some kind of way, and kind of come up with a feeling about the answer. Prerequisite is you got to have this one and this one and this one and this one and this one. Your position is they're prerequisites.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, they cannot all be prerequisites because one of them is the amount involved and the results obtained, which has been critical not only for this case but also the decisions of Barker v. Ekman and Young versus Qualls. We're never going to know what the results obtained are until after the verdict has come back. So by the very language by that very language, they cannot be prerequisites, but it is our position that they do need to comply with the Arthur Anderson factors.
Do you believe that the attorney's fees can ever be reasonably awarded in an amount that exceeds what's requested in damages?
Your Honor, you would have to take into account all of the Arthur Anderson factors, and there is even case law that allows for the return for the recovery of attorney's fees when little or no damages are awarded, for example, under the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act. However, those fees still must be properly proven up. There must be, and they must be considered reasonable under the Arthur Anderson factors.
I understand. You're on the jury now. You're a juror. There's all the factors are proven up. And the attorney's fees of all of your colleagues on the jury, in their opinion, that $50,000 is reasonable, the amount in attorney's fees, and the amount recovered was $40,000. Do you join the verdict or do you not?
Well, I suppose, Your Honor, if I'm looking at reasonableness in light of the results obtained, I personally might not think that that $50,000 might be reasonable, but I would have to have all the evidence in front of me.
So it's possible that a $40,000 recovery with $50,000 in attorney's fees could be reasonable if, for example, the other side was really obstreperous. You had to fight tooth and nail, lots of discovery, unnecessary, but you had to fight all the way through that to get your client's $40,000 recovery. Those kinds of factors might sway you toward concluding that attorney's fees award could, under certain circumstances, exceed the actual damages?
Your Honor, the only time that I've seen that would be in something like the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act, where a statute specifically cites it. All of the other decisions that I'm familiar with on this issue, for example, in Barker versus Ekman, this court actually remanded that issue back to the trial court when the attorney's fees did ultimately exceed the actual results obtained. What we're asking for is that the fees continue to be reasonable in light of the results obtained and in light of the decisions in Arthur Anderson, Barker, and Young.
So what does the trial court do as a practical matter? Does the trial court then say, jury, y'all hang on, let me see what I'm going to do with the attorney's fees because I've gotten a result here that's kind of weird, and you go into another phase of trial where you say you have to award something and consider these factors, or do you just let them go and have a new trial with a new jury on attorney's fees?
Your Honor, I suppose the issue of attorney's fees could actually be bifurcated. And have a just like exemplary damages are. That's not anything that's actually been. I'm not aware of any case law that has actually addressed the issue, but I suppose that could be a possibility.
But presume they're not. Just as a practical matter, every day in the courts across Texas, do they then just impanel a new jury to decide the attorney's fee issue?
No, Your Honor. I would tend to think that for purposes of judicial economy and also for the same jury, I think for purposes of judicial economy and consistency, you would want to have the same jury who watched the attorneys throughout the entire trial actually be the ones that that consider and award attorney's fees.
The trial court would say, I'm throwing out your attorney's fee award. Come back and try again. I'm just trying to figure out how this, what's a court to do in this situation?
I think under the hypothetical that you've presented, Your Honor, the jury would come back on the issue of attorney's fees. The judge then has the it would then be up to the judge to determine if the jury's verdict is contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence.
Well, in this case, it's zero. So the trial court throws that out and says, go back in and award some.
Well, in that case, Your Honor, under the case law, the judge would be able to go through and put in an amount that he or she feels is reasonable, which is exactly what the trial judge did in this case, and put in an amount of $7,500 when initially he thought...
No, I understand that, but if everybody had agreed that the judge was the fact finder, we wouldn't be here. Somebody wants the jury to decide it. And so what, I'm just trying to figure out what a judge is to do in that situation.
I think what a judge is to do in that situation, Your Honor, is to listen to the jury verdict on attorney's fees, evaluate the evidence. If it is contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence, then the judge can go through, issue his or her own decision on that. And then it can, and then like any other post-judgment motion, it could be considered by the appropriate appellate court.
About an additor procedure. Judge says, I'm going to award this amount or we're going to grant a new trial. You got a choice.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
It's an additor. You can do that in Louisiana, but not Texas.
Okay. I'm never practiced law in Louisiana, Your Honor.
It's all different.
I'll take your word for it. In a situation like that, Your Honor, the trial judge could grant a new trial with respect to attorney's fees, which was actually offered to the respondent in this case and declined.
I see there are no further questions. I think we're ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Hayes will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The court's charge in this case as to attorney's fees solely consisted upon what is a reasonable fee for the necessary services of TAM's attorneys, which is the respondent in this case. In this case, that was the entire, there were no instructions regarding any factors. There were no instructions requested by either party. There were no objections filed whatsoever. This court in the Osterberg versus Pekka case stated that the court's charge, not some other identified law, measures the sufficiency of the evidence when there has been no objection.
But if the jury had awarded the $47,000, everything you asked for, in the verdict, it goes up on appeal and the appellate court cuts substantially the damages award under Barker versus Ekman, they would be required to reverse that and send it back for another jury trial, right?
Your Honor, in the situation of a Ragsdale-type situation...
Now, I mean, we've just written on this. Barker says jury gives an award of $100,000 and a attorney fee of $47,000. If it goes up on appeal and the Court of Appeals cuts half of the actual damages, I mean, we explicitly said unless the Court of Appeals is certain that the jury would have awarded exactly that same amount of attorney's fees, that it didn't matter what the amount of damages was, then the right result is reverse and do a jury trial again.
But, Your Honor, in this case, you do not have any difference in a damages award. The Court of Appeals has done nothing with the damages award.
In Barker, did they instruct as to the results obtained being one of the factors? In this case, you didn't. I know in your case, you just said, what's a reasonable attorney's fee?
Yes.
Did Barker just submit it on a global instruction like that, or do you recall?
I do not recall, Your Honor. I do not recall. Again, many of the cases, again, cited reference when there's a damage award where the Court of Appeals cuts that, then you do go look at the issue of the results obtained. In this case, that did not occur at the Court of Appeals. It was $65,000 damage awarded by the jury, and that issue, while appealed on several other grounds, the specific number was not modified. That was not changed.
Right. The actual damages wasn't.
But actual damages.
The attorney's fees was changed a lot because the jury said zero.
Yes.
And the Court of Appeals decided, no, we think $47,000 is better. Isn't that exactly the same? I understand it's not actual damages, it's the attorney's fees, but the Court of Appeals is just changing the verdict. Can they do that without a jury?
Under the Ragsdale progressive, going through that scenario, again, when there is no cross-examination, you go through those elements that there's no cross-examination, etc.
I'm troubled by Ragsdale. If this was the doctor bill of $100,000 and the jury said zero and it comes up to the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals says, no, that's against great weight and preponderance, the Court of Appeals couldn't say $100,000. great weight and preponderance reversal requires a new trial. If it was lost profits, and the jury said zero, against the great weight and preponderance reversal, new trial. How come is attorney's fees the only area where, if the jury says zero, the Court of Appeals can just substitute its judgment for the jury?
From my understanding, it is, Your Honor, by the nature of attorney's fees, and I'm not sure.
What is it about the nature? Is it because we're all attorneys? Is there anything other than that is the reason why we get a different rule from everybody else?
I don't know. My personal opinion at times, it may still be that certain jurors in some way have something against attorneys or they're going to get paid money.
I agree with that. I've never seen juries cut damages more than they do on attorney's fees. But the question is that enough reason to say then juries don't have the right at the first instance to say what the attorney's fees are?
With the protection that Ragsdale states in that it essentially says if the jury amount is incredible, and it uses various words, free from internal contradictions, inaccuracies, or suspicious circumstances. So it does obviously protect if an attorney goes in and asks for $1 million on a $10,000 contract, that the trial court or court of appeals has some degree can come in and say, if this is out of the realm of any kind of reality, then we're going to step in or send this back to a jury.
Send that back to a jury. So if the court of appeals just thinks, personally, we think you asked for too much, then you get a new jury. But if we personally think, it looks reasonable, then we just enter the award. That sure does look like substituting a court of appeals judgment for a juror's.
Well, again, I guess I'll still go back to the, I don't know if I call it safety net or ceiling, that this court in Ragsdale said if it reaches some level of being incredible, they're going to jump in. But otherwise, that then the, again, because the, in, again, in the Ragsdale situation, the other side had, again, ample opportunity to cross-examine, to put on expert witness, and
for whatever reason,
they chose to do nothing, which, again, right, may be a factor of they chose to take that tack unless it comes in incredible.
But it's not entirely free of inconsistency if the evidence comes in the context of a damage claim of multiple times the attorney's fee. And then, you know, once the Court of Appeals is now looking at it, says, well, is it free of any kind of inconsistency here now in light of the jury's decision on actual damages? I mean, does Ragsdale even then apply?
Like Ragsdale would still apply, however, if the court in some way viewed the Anderson factors and said, I think you still look at almost the incredible side of it, this was a $10,000 damage award and $1 million in attorney's fees, and I think under the Ragsdale language of suspicious or incredible, the Court of Appeals at that point could say one of the factors to view is this an incredible result is the comparison of the results obtained as opposed to the attorney's fees sought. So I think there's still, under Ragsdale, there is protection from this situation. From that situation occurring.
Maybe a concern with Ragsdale is, and it does say what you say it says, that the evidence in that case and in this case was uncontradicted on attorney's fees. There's no evidence of any other amount or that the amount should be zero. But maybe what Ragsdale doesn't consider is that the jury doesn't have to believe the witness. And then that takes us back to the examples about actual damages for, let's say, bodily injury, where the jury may not believe the witness, but you got to concede that it costs something to get where you got. Mm-hmm. What do you think happens in that situation? To modify Ragsdale, or do we say for attorney's fees, unlike other areas, that if you don't challenge the attorney's fees, and that's the only evidence of that amount of attorney's fees in the record, that the court can just enter that amount.
Respondent would contend that in the situation of attorney's fees, because the law is clear that a case that goes to trial and that side's the prevailing party, that obviously there were some reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. So you get to that particular level, and then applying the other Ragsdale, they didn't attempt to challenge this whatsoever, and if it's not beyond the incredible realm, then those fees would be awarded. If not, then the trial court becomes the solution, or where that would go, then the trial court essentially becomes, in every instance with a zero award of attorney's fees, the fact finder on attorney's fees.
But your argument's not limited to zero. If the jury had awarded $40,000 here instead of $47,000, but the only evidence uncontested is $47,000, it sounds to me like your argument is under Ragsdale, every time we get $47,000. Doesn't matter what the jury does. If it gives us half, it gives us 80%. If it gives us zero, if it's uncontested, we get it all.
Or if it's $7,500.
That is your position, right?
That would be my position under Ragsdale, and for the reasons that's been developed, and I guess the problems, and do it another way.
Then the exception in Ragsdale is just as troubling to me. If the deal is, if it's beyond the, I forget, what did you say the language was? If it's beyond belief, let's say. You get 100% of what you ask unless it's beyond belief. But in a state where we're electing judges, on the local trial level, this is usually going to be a campaign contributor and a judge making that call. And that's just going to look, whatever he decides or she decides, that's just going to look terrible, that the person who contributed to your last campaign either is always beyond belief or not beyond belief. I mean, in a state where we elect judges, that's one of the main reasons we want the juries to decide everything, because it's just going to look bad when the attorneys contribute to campaigns. What's your response to that?
Well, certainly, in the zero answer, we know what the response is. If, in fact, the jury comes out with some, I guess, potentially reasonable matter, reasonable number, then potentially that number sticks. But again, with this situation being a zero amount and the law as it stands on this, I guess it's still a trial tactic issue that the other side chooses in attorney's fees cases, then I'm just not going to contest it. And probably even in a damages case, where you're left with that is that, well, that's, you know, is it beyond some realm or beyond something that wasn't proven in this particular case?
Did y'all have any conversation with the judge or each other before or after the jury came back with this verdict about why don't we just waive a jury and submit this to the judge?
No, we did not.
Why is it everybody in federal court does that? And nobody in state court does that. Can you tell me that from a practitioner standpoint? I've never heard of a federal judge trying it to a jury. Everybody waives it and tries it to the judge. They're just more trusted than our state district judges are? Or?
My answer is that if I was a defendant in state court, I would always want the jury, the attorney's fees, to go to a jury, because all I can do really is go down from, hopefully they go down from,
because they're not going to like lawyers, so they're going to cut it.
Unfortunately, I think that's my general opinion.
There's kind of an underlying question here, and that is, should we overrule Ragsdale, and so that in all these cases, no matter how it's instructed to the jury, no matter what the court's charge says, if there's evidence of attorney's fees from one side, and they say it's reasonable and necessary, and the jury awards zero damages, that those always are remanded for a new trial to a new jury. And so my question to you is, why should we overrule Ragsdale, and if not, why not?
In this type of situation with a defense to attorney's fees, I think that may promote no response ever to attorney's fees and just hope that this kind of situation comes in where they come in with a small amount of fees, where there's not a concern if they don't fight it, then they're not going to be, maybe bad word, it's stuck what the other side proves up. Again, I think a large component of this is they have taken the position, we're not going to contest this whatsoever. Didn't even question me as to any of the work that was done in the
case. So you're saying, in effect, in any number of cases, the lawyers agree the attorney's fees that are requested are basically reasonable. Why cross-examine this person? That evidence is okay, and the jury's probably going to find that, and what we're really talking about is the underlying damages or liability. And if we've got a problem, then we can, as you say, cross-examine, ask for the Anderson factors to be submitted, make a bigger contest of
it. Certainly, in this case, and again, I would contend that this entire issue has been waived by the fact that case I cite, and the fact that there was no instructions requested or objections to the particular question. There certainly was evidence presented on the question that's asked, so you don't get to the particular factors. But again, if the factors, you know, are there, then arguably you could say in that situation, if there's no evidence that is presented, then the defense just sits there and argues the factors that are there, and they didn't meet this, didn't meet this, didn't meet this. Not saying that necessarily overrules Progressive, but that's, again, that's not the facts of this particular case.
Well, there's another alternative. Opposing counsel could listen to the examination of a witness and on attorney's fees or any other matter and conclude, well, they have the burden of proving up the basis for recovery, and opposing counsel may conclude they didn't get there. But if I get up and cross-examine, I'm going to alert the other side to some things potentially, so I'm going to let it go because I'm going to win on appeal. That's a strategic decision opposing counsel may make, which would then result in, if correct, a position like petitioner's taken, that you just didn't get there at trial and should be reversed. Sent back perhaps for a new trial on it, but you didn't get there the first time. That's another possibility as well.
It's an absolute possibility. Again, it's a decision for the opposing side on attorney's fees that you know they're making, that they may win on some other ground.
But if Ragsdale were the law, that would be based on the idea that this is preposterous, or I forgot all the other adjectives you used, the exceptions to the court's ability to find an amount. And under this, I don't see that in this record. I mean, there's no suggestion that this is just, pulled from thin air, this amount that was testified to.
Yes, again, in this situation, I think the entirety of the fee bills were provided. They did have detailed entries. There was a cover sheet that had the particular hours at the rates of the various attorneys. So that, again, that was a situation where it was, we believe it was fully and properly proven up. In conclusion, it's the respondent's position that number one, the entire issue now would be waived to go in and because there was not objection to that, to fight this particular issue when at the trial court level there was no objection to these other criteria even being applied. And following that under the Ragsdale, which I believe the petitioner contends was properly applied based upon the evidence in this case, properly applied, that the standards were met, that for the three prongs, that it wasn't incredible, the evidence was direct, clear, and concise, and that situation with a zero result, then the trial court abused its discretion by giving any number but zero.
Well, I'm curious because Rule 295 in the Rules for Procedure provides for correcting a verdict while the jury's still there. If the jury doesn't answer one of the questions, or in this case answers a question with an unacceptable verdict, the trial judge can instruct them in writing and send them back in to try harder. And why wasn't that done? I mean, everybody knew when you got the zero, that's not right.
and we're going to have to do something about it. We could have fixed this right at the moment by a written instruction of the jury. Ladies and gentlemen, it says some amount, and you can't put zero, so put something in there. That would have fixed it, right?
I don't have an answer other than that wasn't done. That wasn't done. In conclusion, again, respondents would...
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear why that wasn't done. Jury awards zero. You don't want to go back and try again.
Thank you.
I'll give you $2.
I didn't mean to sound flippant. I didn't have the rule in front of me. Yes, it was not done. And it
But you know, that's the bad thing and the good thing about the jury system. They can do whatever they want, right? Now, what we've got here is... The jury wanted one thing, and the Court of Appeals just did something else. That's a bit of a problem if you have a right to a jury trial on attorney's fees, isn't it?
Well, in this situation, we contend that the Court of Appeals did what, at that point, that there was no other choice. Anything the jury came back with would have had to have been the particular number the Court of Appeals awarded.
Why don't we agree with the trial judge who said $7,500 was proper?
Under Ragsdale, the trial court judge at that point would be abusing his discretion to do anything but award the reasonable attorney's fees that were uncontested, proven, direct, clear, concise. Again, it goes back to the question. I guess the alternative is, in cases like this, you then just make the trial court judge the finder of fact, and going back to Ragsdale and cases following that, that's not the way it's been done. And again, it's uncontested, but clear, concise evidence.
But again, at least as you interpret Ragsdale, it does not allow the jury to disbelieve parts of the testimony of the amount of attorney's fees. It's whole hog, so long as that testimony is uncontested. The jury may look at the bills and say the attorney said this is the amount I expended and it's reasonable and necessary, but the jury may say, you know, he billed 26 hours in this day, or may see some reasons to make deductions. But
I think that's right. Now, the safety net, again, is if the defendant wants to make that kind of argument or present something to the contrary. Again,
and they have to do it on cross-examination or contrary evidence.
Contrary evidence, because again, we are talking about expert testimony in this particular case, and that's kind of the Ragsdale obviously is prefaced on with expert testimony. At certain times, got to live with it if A, B, and C occur.
Thank you, Counselor.
This has been a summary judgment, and they put on an affidavit of 47,000 attorney's fees, and you all put on nothing. You can enter summary judgment for 47,000, right?
Depending on the adequacy of the affidavit and the ultimate results obtained, then yes, Your Honor, that could be proper.
Why shouldn't we do the same thing to people that don't bother to do any cross-examination or call their own expert or anything else?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, in this case, Mr. Hayes was cross-examined. And after the cross-examination and the evaluation of all of the evidence, the jury chose, apparently, not to believe Mr. Hayes. What I'd like to do is start by addressing the issue of the fees as being incredible in the hypothetical that Mr. Hayes discussed in his presentation. The fees in this case, we would argue, were incredible. The trial judge himself in the post-judgment hearing referred to the respondent's attorney's fees as huge. They don't normally get this high, and it was the trial judge's opinion that $5,000 was normally what he considered to be a reasonable fee for a suit on a guarantee. While he did ultimately award $7,500, the trial judge, still in his discretion and evaluation of the evidence, including the results obtained, felt that decided what a reasonable fee would be. So when we're discussing the issue of what fees are incredible, that does apply to the respondent's fees on a case like this. With respect to Justice Brister's discussion, the doctor analogy, what we're looking at is the situation of fee shifting. As it's discussed in Arthur Anderson, the mere fact that a lawyer and a client have agreed to a particular fee is not sufficient to shift that burden over to a third party. We see this with respect to the doctor analogy all the time. A patient and a doctor may agree on a certain fee. The patient then submits it to his insurance company, who doesn't feel that those fees are reasonable and actually awards less.
They usually don't feel any fee is reasonable.
Your Honor, that's a different conversation for a different day. There's been a lot of discussion during respondents' presentation about Ragsdale. Ragsdale was a first step, but Arthur Anderson, this Court has made clear, is the controlling law on this issue. It's not just the Arthur Anderson opinion itself. We can look at the recent opinions of Barker versus Ekman and Young versus Qualls.
Let me ask you, Barker versus Ekman, were the Arthur Anderson factors included in the instruction to the jury, or do you recall that?
They were, Your Honor. 7 of the 8 factors were presented to the jury in that case.
That was different than your case here, because you didn't submit them.
They were not submitted in this case, Your Honor, but just because they're not submitted does not mean that those factors are even though the factors were not submitted to the jury, they still do need to apply.
Is it your position that we ignore what the jury's told to use as the law in reaching their result?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that.
Is the jury supposed to follow that law?
The jury, the trial court judge and the appellate court justices should follow the law.
Okay, so is the trial court then bound by what he instructed to the jury?
I don't believe the trial court is bound by what he instructed the jury. Even if he properly instructed the jury under Cain v. Bain.
We presume he properly instructed the jury, don't we? He told the jury just to consider what's reasonable and necessary, did not give the factors.
That's correct.
Okay, and so your position is even though he told the jury to do that, he then can later, he and the Court of Appeals later, should consider other factors and second-guess the jury using other factors that the jury was not given. And there was no objection to the failure to give those to the jury.
There was no objection to the charge on that issue, Your Honor. However, even after the verdict is given, the trial court judge can't go through and consider the results obtained factor until after the verdict has already been given.
The jury was not told to consider it this case anyway. So why should the trial judge consider in reviewing what the jury did, why would the trial judge consider something he or she did not tell the jury to consider? Seems to me like you're asking the jury to do something and then you're looking at it on some other factors and second-guessing what the jury did on other factors if we do it that way.
Well, ultimately, Your Honor, in this case, I feel that the jury verdict should not be disturbed on a question, an issue of attorney's fees. When it's a jury trial, the jury is the fact finder, and the deference should be given to the jury. May I have just a brief concluding sentence, Your Honor?
Sure.
Your Honors, for the reasons that we've discussed, fairness demands and the law that requires that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.